Hi FM, 101.9 megahertz of life.
Dr. Carl joins us, as he does every Wednesday. He is our science communicator. Good morning. How are you?
Pretty good, apart from having a mild upper respiratory tract infection. I have tested myself. It's not COVID. And the thing is that after we've had a period, during which time we've had social distancing, masks, etc., the standard viruses have not been coming around. So in Australia, in the year 2019, we had 20,000 cases of flu over all of Australia. 1 year later, in a lockdown, 200. And so now the viruses, whatever they are, mild upper respiratory tract viruses, have had a chance to breed. And here they are having a good time in my body. And who am I to deny them the right to live?
Absolutely. You know, you're such a good guy that way. But we've noticed that here as well in South Africa, a lot of people getting sick, all sorts of strange viruses of all types. So this is a global problem, I would imagine.
Yes, simply because we've been doing a bit of lockdowning. And it's part of the ongoing, you might say, battle between other smaller creatures like bacteria, viruses, parasites, and us. Nothing personal, it's just business. We want to live and have babies. They want to have live and have babies.
I love that.
And kind of we think we're more important, have more right to it, because we humans are the peak of evolution, having invented poetry, weapons of mass destruction, and income tax.
Right. Absolutely right. So the question is as well, a lot of people are saying, you see, this has happened. We've worn our masks. We've social distances. Now our immunity is low. Is it about us or is it about them, the virus?
I don't know the answer to that. I just simply say the virus wants to live. And what we've got to do is say we also deserve to live. And at the moment in Australia, the virus is killing about an aeroplane load, a jetliner full of people every week. And then when we get the more vaccines coming through, the better drugs, will drop that down to one or even zero per week.
Let's talk about other things. And the one conversation we wanted to have with you today is about visual illusions. What are visual illusions?
Visual illusions are when you look at the world around you and suddenly it doesn't fit in with your normal understanding of life. So there's three sorts of visual illusions. There's the physical one, where you get a stick and it's definitely straight and looks definitely straight, and then you put it into a pond and it looks bent. Okay, that's one. The second one is physiological, to do with your body, and somebody takes a photograph of you with a flash, and for a few moments you see bright lights in front of you. They're not real, they're just part of your physiology responding. And then we have the famous ones, the cognitive ones, where the moon on the horizon when it's full looks so much bigger than the same moon just a few hours later, even though it should look smaller because it's further away. And then there's different types of cognitive visual illusions, and they all teach us something about consciousness. But the overall reason why it happens is that there's just simply too much information flooding in from the outside. And so the brain has got all these little algorithms or programs that just runs everything through past experience. And then secondly, we also live 3/10 of a second behind reality. Have I mentioned that before, Dr. Howard?
No, that is, what do you mean we live? Just say that again.
We live 3/10 of a second behind reality.
Wow.
So we can definitely, for example, set off a stimulus. Like suddenly there's a picture of a car, you know, there's a blank screen, and then suddenly you put a picture of a car up on the screen, and we can do that in 1/1000 of a second really quickly. And then the light lands on your retina, gets processed in your retina. Then after processing and compression, goes through the two optic nerves, one from each eye, crosses over in the optic chiasm, goes to the visual processing centers at the back of your head, also called Brodmann's areas 19, 20, and 21. And then 3/10 of a second later, only then, in full 3D color, do you see the car suddenly pop up on the screen. And so when you're meeting somebody and you're in the kitchen and you're talking with them and they pour you a cup of tea, they might be moving, you might be moving, but then you've learned to compensate for that 3/10 of a second overload, you know, 3/10 of a second delay. So the combination of too much information flooding in, plus you're always trying to predict the future, that makes it easier to have visual illusions. And there are certain types of people, such as schizophrenics, who have difficulty with what they call top-down processing, who don't actually see the visual illusions that the rest of us see.
Absolutely fascinating. And it's so interesting. Of course, it makes sense that we are processing things that have already happened, and it does take just a little bit of time to understand that. Can we just go back for 1 second to that moon thing? Because
yeah.
I want to try and understand that, why sometimes the moon looks the size that it does.
Okay, so firstly, when the moon is directly above you, you know, a few hours after it rises, when the moon is directly above you, it's a certain distance away from the center of the Earth.
Right.
But when the moon is on the horizon, just after sunrise, it's that distance plus the radius of the Earth, another 6,000 kilometers.
Mm.
So firstly, on the horizon, the moon is further away, so it should look smaller. Secondly, if you do the mathematics of the air bending the light, it actually makes the light, the image, look smaller. So if you take a photograph of the moon on the horizon and straight above, and then blow it up, blow them both up, and then measure them with a ruler, definitely the moon on the horizon you measure to be smaller with a ruler. But with a naked eye, forget it. Man, it looks bigger, even though we know that it should be, and in fact turns out to be, smaller.
Absolutely fascinating. The other thing I wanted to ask you is why autumn leaves are so many colors. I mean, I happen to love it. It's gorgeous.
Yeah, we don't have many native Australian trees doing this autumn leaf thing. So it turns out that there's a chemical in leaves called chlorophyll, which turns light into electricity and then energy.
Mm-hmm.
And there's a whole class of these molecules that have got four little, you know, like a little clover leaf. So they've got four little leaves, and then in the middle, you've got a different atom. So in humans, we call it hemoglobin, and that's got iron in the middle, whereas in the case of the plants, it's got magnesium in the middle. In cobalt, if you have cobalt in the middle, it gives you vitamin B6. If you put in nickel in the middle, you get a different chemical called coenzyme F430. If you put copper in the middle, you get the blood pigment found in insects and creatures, but in plants, it's magnesium, and magnesium is pretty rare in the environment. So the first thing that happens when winter comes is that they try to recycle the chlorophyll so they can grab some of that magnesium. Or if they also experience extreme heat, they're feeling threatened, and so they'll pull back the chlorophyll, and then the other pigments that are in the plant will then come forward if you pull away. Chlorophyll is a green color, but there are other chemicals in there called anthocyanins. There's about a dozen different chemicals, all with long names, and depending on what sort of plant it is, it gives the plant a different color.
And finally, atmospheric rivers. We've heard about these. They were discovered when? Back in the 90s.
Yeah. So we've been having immense storms where over one city alone, Brisbane, we had about 8 cubic kilometers of water drop in a few days.
Whoa.
Massive flooding, rivers, buildings, humans had bad things. It was really bad. So these atmospheric rivers were discovered about 25 years ago, and we now know that they're a stream of moist air goes from the ground up to a few kilometers up, thousands, like 5 or 10,000 kilometers long, and a few hundred kilometers wide, and they're a giant yet invisible conveyor belt of water in the sky. And they carry moisture in enormous amounts. So a typical one will be discharging past a point more water than the Amazon River does, about 2.5 times more than the Amazon, and that's the biggest river on Earth. So these atmospheric rivers account for 90% of the global movement of water from the equator to the pole, about 22% of all global runoff. But in California, it accounts for 75% of all the water that people drink, and that water is just dropped there in 10 days of the year. And with global warming, we're pumping about 600,000 Hiroshima bombs worth of heat into the system, and these atmospheric rivers are becoming more powerful, and so we're ending up with massive damage. So we've had 2 years of massive damage on the Australian coast after the where we had in 2020 we had one-fifth of all forests in Australia burnt, so including forests, 10%, that were rainforests and had never been burnt in the last 35,000 years. Then the next 2 years we had massive rains. You're getting situations where in one spot there's as much rain in a night as in the preceding 5 months.
Unbelievable.
And yeah, so these atmospheric rivers are really going to, we're discovering them now, they're going to be a big factor in the cost of climate change. But the good news is that we can stop and reverse global warming at a cost of one quarter of the subsidies that we give to fossil fuel companies anyway.
It is 7:30. Dr. Carl, thank you as always. What a fascinating conversation. I'm Howard Feldman. This is your Morning Mayhem. It's 101.9 Chai FM. Good morning.